Well, if you'll open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 5, we are going to tackle this chapter this evening as we've gone through each chapter here in the book of Joshua. And we've seen really in the opening chapters of Joshua to this point, I think the Holy Spirit revealing to us some fundamental aspects of living a life of victory, of living a life of confidence in our Lord. And we saw last time we were together in chapter 4 the value in memorials of remembrance. And among other things, we saw that the wonderful works of God are worthy of treasuring in our memories. We talked about the fact that as Christians, we all know of those occasions where God has intervened in a mighty way in our life and done a mighty work and allowing us to make a great testimony. Simply a testimony of saying that God really came through for me here. Or God really came through for us as a family. And those kinds of things are so worthy of treasuring within our memories. And the same thing was happening as we saw in chapter 4 as the stone memorials were there for Israel as, again, a great testimony that God really came through for us as they just now have passed through the River Jordan. We also saw that through these memories that we should seek to make provision for informing the next generation of God's greatness. Again, the memorial stones were there not only to remind them of the great work that God had done in just recent past for them, but it was also there constructed to elicit questions from subsequent generations. And it would be there as a testimony, again, as I said, almost like a sermon in stone, to allow the elders, to allow the parents to answer the questions that you would expect from children that would say, why are these here? And they'd be able to say, let me tell you what God did. Let me tell you the incredible way that He worked and what good application that is for us and how we can share with our children and point them to the things that we see God doing, not only in our families, but even what we see doing in their lives and how important that is. And we also saw that these memorials remind us that God is faithful. That God is faithful to keep His promise of redemption. He is faithful here to bring Israel, as we see now, into the promised land. They are standing in the land. God had promised this to Abraham, to his seed, that this would be their land, and now they're there. The promise is there, and again, these stones of memorials here were helped to reinforce the fact that God is faithful to His promises that He's made. And again, stones of remembrance that we see even in our own life of God's great work, of His grace in our life, and of His mercy and His mighty power that has operated within us. It serves to strengthen us. Again, as we recall on the things God has done, it strengthens us. And that's exactly what these memorial stones in chapter 4 that we covered were to do. They were assembled there to strengthen Joshua and to strengthen the nation. There again, what stood there were 12 stones in their encampment at Gilgal as a constant reminder of the great events that had just happened. They were there so that as Joshua looked upon those stones, he was reminded of the ark as it was carried into the river. And as the priests carrying the ark entered the river, the waters piled up, we are told, to the north, piled up all the way to the city of Adam. The riverbed became dry. And then it was to remind Joshua, having that picture for him, of the masses crossing the riverbed. Literally hundreds of thousands of people, of men and women and children and the flocks crossing in mass across the river. And at the same time, right after that, we know that the warriors, the rear guard of Israel, we are told, crossed in full armor. And then as the priests carrying the ark exited the riverbed, as the last step was taken out of that bed, the rivers came back and resumed their normal flow. What an incredible event. And these stones were there as a memorial, of a reminder of God's incredible power and His work within our lives and within their lives. And so now as we come, as this is a way of background into chapter 5, it starts by giving us a description of the effects of this River Jordan miracle that it had upon the inhabitants of the land, the inhabitants of Canaan. And we discussed this a little last time, but it's a great beginning of chapter 5. And if you'll follow with me, let's look at verse 1 of chapter 5. And it says here, "And so it was, when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. And as we noted last time when we were together, the Canaanites and the Amorites of the land were completely demoralized, realizing that their a complete inability, really, to successfully oppose a people whose God was truly God, who was a God over all creation, over all physical forces and power, and their hearts melted. And so now, starting in verse 2, we are going to pick up now with the next step that God has for the people. We've been following their preparation all the way along for these last four chapters, now into chapter 5, of taking the land, and we see a next step that God has for them as he prepares them to take the land. And so let's look now at verses 2 through 9, and we'll read through that. It says, "At that time the Lord said to Joshua, 'Make flint knives for yourselves and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time.' So Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers that he gave to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then Joshua circumcised the sons whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised, because they had not been circumcised along the way. So it was, when they had finished circumcising all the people, that they stayed in their places in the camp until they were healed. And then the Lord said to Joshua, 'This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you.' Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day." Stop there for a minute. And here in verses 2 through 9, we have recorded for us what took place, at least initially, in this encampment at Gilgal, namely the circumcision, the circumcising of Israel. And the previous narration that we looked at, remember in chapter 4, informed us that they arrived at this place 4 days before the Passover. And we spoke about God's incredible timing here and how he would have the people enter into the land of promise, graced with the most important religious feast, that of Passover. Again, another memorial for them. A memorial, really, to remind them of their deliverance from Egypt. And now further, a memorial to remind them of their deliverance through the River Jordan. And a reminder that they are at the end of 40 years of wandering. What an incredible time this would be. What a great celebration that it would be. And the necessary prerequisite, the necessary qualification to participate in this great Passover celebration and this feast now in the new land is that circumcision was required. And we know this because the instructions for Passover found for us in Exodus 12, verse 48, said that no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. And so now we see the Lord now coming to him and saying, this is something that needs to be done before the Passover is celebrated here. And it's indicated in this text that during those lengthy wanderings in the wilderness, that the children of Israel had apparently departed from this ordinance of circumcision here. For 40 years, we know that the nation was condemned by God to wander in the wilderness until that entire generation died off because of their unbelief and their refusal to enter the promised land the first time around. And it appears that during this time, the children did not bear the mark of that covenant relationship to God until now, until this point in time. And certainly God viewed Israel as his people. He has just brought them through an amazing way through the River Jordan. and they were once again to receive the sign of the covenant upon their bodies. And again, circumcision, as we all know, was the sign of the Abrahamic covenant. We know from Genesis chapter 17. And this ordinance was to be a mark by which the seed of Abraham was to be distinguished from all other nations, to be as a people in a special covenant with God. And that covenant also secured Abraham's seed the land of promise. You see, as aspects of that covenant, it included this promised land that God would give to them. And therefore, now that they have entered into that land, that they are literally standing in that land, it was fitting that this second generation should now be circumcised to again refresh this commitment to God's covenant. But something else that I see here that might be a little bit more subtle is I see in this whole event too a tremendous testing of Joshua's faith. A great testing of his faith. That here, as they've entered into the land, you understand, they're in the plains of Jericho. I mean, it's right before them, this next great fortified city. They are in the enemy's land, in their territory, basically. And now, God is calling upon Joshua to do this act upon all of the males, so that for several days now, they're going to be completely incapacitated, really, for fighting. I could only imagine how incapacitating that could be, at least for a few days on this thing. And you look at this and you think, what military general, you know, we could think of, would handicap or would actually maim his troops, you know, before he launches a full-scale, you know, offensive against a fortified enemy? But God had intended that he himself would govern the camp of Israel, that they would not be governed by some worldly, man-centered policy. So we see Joshua here, by faith, I see, by great faith, was counting upon the Lord's protection. Remember, the people are out in the open here. The enemy is behind a great wall. They are vulnerable, and yet Joshua, by faith, follows through with what God calls him to do and tells him to do, and by faith he does it, relying on the Lord's protection. We see by faith his confidence is in God, and that confidence triumphs over any doubt in regard to the timing of this request that God has for him. Again, a great exercise and a great demonstration of Joshua's faith here. Let's look now at verse 10. It tells us now what transpired from there. It says, "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho." Again, we see, as we talked before, they arrived on the day of preparation, on the 10th of the first month, or the 10th of Nisan, and yet now here, on the 14th of Nisan, they celebrate Passover. And I see again here a real commitment to obedience by the people, to do all that Joshua had commanded them, as God had commanded Joshua. And there's a number of you would might think, in terms of soldiers, now, like I say, they are in the field. They are basically not far from where the enemy is, in enemy territory, basically on the battlefield. And yet, you know, you would think a lot of soldiers here might consider themselves exempted from a lot of ceremony because of the position and the vulnerability that they're in right now. And yet we see here Joshua opens this campaign, really the first time they're going to encounter the people of the land. He opens this campaign with one act of devotion after another. And Israel here keeps the Passover, as we're told in verse 10. And again, like the circumcising of the people, it was an act of obedience to the Lord, as well as an act of remembrance. As we looked at the remembrance of all that encompassed. Again, this feast we know, the Passover feast, was appointed to celebrate, really, the great goodness of the Lord to his people. And it was their deliverance from both bondage and death, really, in Egypt. And, you know, we know that Passover was designed to remind the people of God's amazing protection. On a night when the angel of death passed through their midst, and yet we also see it was an aspect of this provision of the Paschal Lamb's blood that was an all-sufficient provision for saving. As they put the blood on the doorpost, it was a fully sufficient provision to save. And I look at that and say, what a beautiful picture of Christ that is. And His blood is all sufficient for our salvation. And this feast was to express again the gratitude of the people to God, their gratitude for His favor toward them. And when I think of Passover and I read of it and such, Passover truly manifests the grace of God. You know, again, we think about the children of Israel. By nature, the children of Israel were no better than the Egyptians, just as we are no better than anyone else. They were no better in that regard, but it was out of the Lord's good pleasure, out of the Lord's, you know, unmerited favor towards them, that He exempted Israel from the destroyer, and He chose them as His own people. Out of all people, God chose them. And it was a great act of grace, and this, the whole aspect of Passover, that they were saved through this, was again a beautiful picture of God's grace. And we can look at Passover too and see that it further reveals the amazing mercy of God. Of God providing that blood sacrifice and instructing the people, here's what you do. You know, you take of the lamb and you bring it in and bring it among your family, and then on that 14th day, the lamb is sacrificed, the blood is placed on the doorstep, and as that happened, it appeased His wrath and it appeased God's judgment that was passing through their midst, and it was a great picture of God's mercy here. And it also testifies to the faithfulness of God, I see as well, where God said to them, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And He did. He did. He is faithful to what He said. And finally, the Passover feast is, I think, too, in accompanying everything else we said, it really just shows His love as He chose Israel to be His favored people. And so we can see that the Passover feast not only memorialized the past, you know, of what God had done, but that it also was a foreshadow of what was to come. 1 Corinthians 5:7 says, for indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. If you really study throughout the Passover, again, it's a beautiful picture of what was to come, of what Christ was going to do in saving His people. And Passover sets forth, again, this grand truth of redemption. And this feast of remembrance was kept here as Israel entered Canaan. And what an incredible blessing it was. They enter the land, they're there safely, the land under their feet, and now they have this tremendous feast, just celebrating God's grace and His mercy and His faithfulness and His redemption, you see, through the Passover feast. A great celebration. And as the Passover was, we see here, was a prelude to Israel's deliverance from Egypt. So again here, now, as they celebrate it, it was an introduction to this new experience. It was a prelude to their entry into the promised land and into Canaan. And I think it's important to notice that all of Israel followed these sanctifying acts of committing themselves to God in a deeper way before they proceeded any further. And this was a key. This was key in preparing them for trusting God in the great works that still lie ahead. And so this is so true for us too, to really come to a point of consecrating ourselves in the same way and just truly trusting God, especially when we face difficulties, to say, Lord, I consecrate myself to You, and I consecrate towards just trusting in You, you know, and the great work that He would do as He does that in our life. And, you know, again, like I say, we face challenges. We will face spiritual battles in our lives, but it is so important that we consecrate ourselves to trust in Him in all things. Well, let's look now at verses 11 through 12. It says here, and they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and the parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten of the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So we see now, after the Passover, for the first time now, they're in the land. For the first time, they eat of the fruit of the land. And I see here too, it's just showing more so, Israel's ready. God's prepared them all along. They're here. They're ready. They're fully sanctified before the Lord. You know, they are partaking of the fruit of the land. The needed provision of manna now is behind them. You know, the flood stage River Jordan now is behind them. And now, really, straight before them, was the famous walled city of Jericho. And most of these Israelites that were here now, they had were born and had been raised in the wilderness. And they had likely never seen a city like this that was right before them. A city that was known for walls that reached to heaven. And they had never experienced really a great battle for a city. And I can imagine that there were some within the camp that were doubting, maybe even complaining about the prospect of going up against such a city as this, against such a fortified city and a fortified people, as they are vulnerable and out in the open. And I sense too that Joshua would be feeling the burden at this time. The nation's ready. God's ready to send them forth against the city. And I can imagine Joshua feeling the burden as the people were looking to his leadership. I say that because you remember back in chapter 1 when Joshua was charged by the Lord to lead these people, that the people responded to him, remember, and they said, "We will do whatever you say, just as we did for Moses, only be strong and courageous." In other words, they're saying, "We're going to follow you, Joshua. You're a leader, but all we're asking is that you be strong and you be courageous, and we will do whatever you tell us to do." And I can imagine being in that situation with a mass of people out in the open going up against a city that looks like a great challenge, and yet feeling the pressure, feeling really the burden that would be there upon a leader. And so we'll see next as we read that Joshua leaves the camp here and that he goes out from the camp. And we're going to find he's going to be right next to Jericho. So in essence, he's out kind of scouting Jericho out for himself with a view to determine what kind of plan of attack. Because remember, he hasn't got really that direction yet. What his plan of attack would be. And I suspect, too, to get out from there to just have some alone time with God. Because he is longing for God's direction. Longing for his direction as this pressure, I'm sure, is mounting. And so let's pick it up in verse 13 as Joshua moves out, and we're going to see the Lord meet him there. It says here, "And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho," again he's right there, "that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, 'Are you for us or for our adversaries?' And so he said, 'No, but the commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come.' And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped, and said to him, 'What does my Lord say to his servant?' Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, 'Take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy.' So Joshua did so." He did so. Verse 13 tells us here, he was by Jericho, as I said. In other words, he was in close proximity to it. And I'm sure he was sensing the greatness of this fortified, walled city as he was there. And there are some, and even I was reading through this, there are some who suggest, why was Joshua out there? Is this an example of a lack of faith on Joshua's part? Because after all, couldn't Joshua have just stayed in the camp? The Lord said this is going to be their battle, or his battle rather, and that their victory, you know, through him. So why doesn't he just stay in the camp? Is he not showing faith by going out there? And I would respond by saying, no, I don't think so. I don't think it's a lack of faith here. Because even when we are fully assured that God is with us and that he will work on our behalf, which, by the way, folks, is true for every one of us as a Christian. We know that's true, that he is with us and he works on our behalf, that we still need to act rationally. We still need to follow all reasonable means and all reasonable precautions so that we can put forth the best effort. And again, granted, God is going to ultimately bring the victory here. No question about it. But we still need to act responsibly. We still need to act rationally. And I'm telling you, that's true if you're a parent leading in your home. You still need to act responsibly and rationally. If you're a leader in your workplace, if you're a leader in the church, you see. And so while Joshua was out performing what I believe is some reasonable reconnaissance for the coming battle, we see that the Lord met him out there. And suddenly for Joshua, what an incredible thing this must have been, suddenly standing before him was an armed soldier with sword drawn. And I imagine that really got his heart rate going. You know, when I read the Bible so often, I try to put myself in there rather than just reading through it, just saying, okay, I'm out there, I'm feeling the pressure, I'm a little nervous, I've got a huge number of people I'm leading against a giant wall. We don't have the tools to defeat this wall. But we're going because God has called us to go. And then suddenly, before me is this figure. And I tell you, my heart would be racing. And I think for most men, upon seeing an ominous figure like this, might have turned and run. But not Joshua. And we know Joshua better than that. Joshua is not that kind of man. And there is nothing to suggest here that Joshua saw this man in some kind of vision or some kind of dream, as though it wasn't real. But rather this figure appeared before him objectively and tangibly and spoke to him. And even though this individual we see here had a drawn sword in his hand, we don't see Joshua panicking and we don't see him fleeing. In fact, the scriptures tell us that Joshua boldly moves towards this person. He moves towards him. And I suspect, this is my opinion, but my suspect is that he had his hand on his own sword as he approaches him and he says, are you for us or are you for our adversary? And again, I see the implication here is that if you are against us, then we're going to do battle right here, right now, you see. And Joshua, I see him, and I think it's clear, he was a brave guy. And he was a feisty guy. Remember, we kind of reviewed Joshua a little bit from Exodus all the way up to this point, and everywhere we see Joshua, where is he? He's in a battle. And he's not the general that's standing back directing his troops. Joshua is in the thick of it every time, right in the middle of the battle. This is a general that was in the middle of the battle, not just a general on the hill. And I think of Joshua and I think of his kind of feistiness. It reminds me of, I'll just tell you, it reminded me of the movie Patton. I don't know if you've seen that movie before, but there's a scene in that where Patton is involved in basically a meeting with his others in charge. And at that time, the city that he's in comes under attack by strafing German fighter planes. And everybody's diving under tables. Out in the streets, people are diving under vehicles. And everybody's taking cover because these planes are coming through, strafing everything. Only they show Patton jumping out of the window. And he gets down in the middle of the street as these planes are making their way back around right towards him. And he's challenging them and say, put one right here. You know, he's telling them, put it right in my forehead as they're coming around. And the guns are firing and the bullets are tearing up the street. And he's standing there and, of course, he pulls out his ivory-handled .45 and he starts shooting at these planes as they go by, challenging them the whole way to just, come on, put one right here. I challenge you, you know. And he was the kind of guy, at least in that movie, depicted as a man who does not back down to anything. And you know what? That's what I see Joshua's like. All the way through the Word, I see Joshua as the same kind of guy. He is a man's man. He is a tough fighter, a general that doesn't back down. And here's this ominous figure. And Joshua's not running backwards. He's not running away. He approaches them and challenges them. Are you for us or are you for our adversary? He wants to know right away. And we see that in this an encounter here, we see Joshua being a guy who doesn't back down. And I see this as a characteristic of all of his leadership. He doesn't do this. And yet we also see that in this encounter that is really covered in just three short verses, that it's going to be a significant event in the entirety of Joshua's spiritual experience. After this, he would go forth in even greater boldness than he had before into battle. And yet as Joshua challenges him as to who you are, we know that this figure identified himself now as the captain of the Lord's host and that he was more than just a man. And Joshua knew this right after that. He knew it. In fact, what we have here is a theophany. We have a pre-incarnate appearing of the Son of God in human form. And this is not the first time this has happened, nor is it the last appearance of the Lord in this manner in the Old Testament. For we know that the Son of God appeared to Hagar in Genesis 16, again to Abraham in Genesis 18, to Jacob in Genesis 32, remember the great wrestling match, and then again to Gideon in Judges 6. And this figure identifies himself, as I said, as commander of the Lord's army. And we see here that Joshua now immediately understood that this was far more than a man that stood before him. And we are told that he fell on his face and worshipped him. And this visitor couldn't have been an angel, because this person would have, if it was an angel, he would have rebuked Joshua's worshiping, but this person accepted it, accepted the worship, making him deity. In addition to this, this figure commanded Joshua, again we see the very familiar command here, he commanded him to remove his shoes as an act of reverence. What was this like? It is identical to what God had commanded Moses at the burning bush. Same words, same thing. This, folks, was Joshua's burning bush experience, you see, of the Lord appearing to him. And we see the same kind of response. Whenever anybody comes to the presence of the Lord, they are on their face. And so was Joshua. And that's why I say this was certainly not an angel, but this was God appearing to Joshua. And this command to remove his shoes, I see, not only linked together the two events of Joshua and Moses, but it supplied to Joshua a needed encouragement. It supplied to him a further assurance of God's original promise to him back in chapter 1, verse 5, where God said, "As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you, and I will never forsake you." And here, these two events are so similar. A reassurance to Joshua is, yes, the Lord is with me. This is the same thing that happened in Moses' time as well. And what an encouragement I see here to faith for him. Great encouragement. I mean, you think now, here's the Lord with the sword drawn, the commander of the Lord's hosts, and he is for him. And you look at this, you say, what army could stand before the captain of the Lord's host? No one. You see, the answer is obvious. No one. You know, what fear would there be for Israel with such a leader as this that was right with them? You see, and it was a sign that that Israel had complete victory coming to them, right ahead of them. Again, this man with the sword drawn in his hand came not as an idle spectator, we see here, but to command and to direct Israel's battles. And at this point, the text, I think, begs for us to make some personal application here, especially in this whole encounter. I see just some wonderful things for us to take away this evening, because we all face situations where we feel less than adequate for it. I'll ask you, have you ever been in a situation where you say, I'm inadequate for this? You know, I'm not up to this task. I mean, everyone's been there. And we will all have these kind of Jericho kind of experiences. And we will face, you know, situations that seem impossible, an impossible challenge for us. And in this text, I think we can see some quality principles for successfully taking on those challenges that come in life, the challenges that even the Lord puts before us to grow us in our faith. And I would say first and most obvious principle that I see in this encounter with the captain of the Lord's hosts for Joshua that's applicable to us, and that is beholding God as powerful and in control. Folks, that is critical. That is absolutely critical, to behold God as powerful and sovereign and in control, and submitting to Him and being aware of His presence in our lives. Joshua sees God, and it puts him on his face